You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Stay tuned at the very, very end of this episode for outtakes from this episode. They are hilarious. Jillian Pensavalli.
Patrick Hines.
Hi, girl.
Hey.
What are we talking about today?
We're talking about Who Took Johnny and my table flipometer. It's pretty up there, you guys. It's up there, if I do say so myself.
Please contact us if you have our son. We'll work with your demands because we want him back.
There was no crime scene. He just vanished.
My husband and I feel we must do what we humanly can as his parents.
There was a lot of fear. They didn't catch the perpetrator. Something like this is going to happen again.
But every time we found a clue, we ran into a brick wall.
And at that moment, when our eyes met, I knew I was going to hear exactly what happened to my son that day.
You have no idea what it's like to look for your missing child. It is hell on earth.
Sunday, September 5th, approximately 6 a.m., 12-year-old John Gosch had been delivering papers in this affluent neighborhood of West Des Moines. That was the last time he was seen.
The parents believe the boy is alive and has been kidnapped.
Johnny, we love you. We're waiting for you to come home. We're doing everything in our power to get you back. Take care, babe.
All right, so if you can put aside for 1 second all of, like, the kidnapping and the horror.
Right.
So we can just, like, focus for just 30 seconds on how 80s everything about this movie is.
It's super 80s, which is accurate because it happened in 1982.
It took place, right? This is not, like, a period piece.
No, but it's, like, so 82.
Every time there's, like, a flashback in the news media or anything, like, the very first thing we see is, like, Jane Pauley with her, like, feathered hair.
Right, yeah.
And she's just, like, it's so 80s. To me.
Lots of shoulder pads, yes. Lots of that, like, kind of shiny material, yes. That, like, the dresses. It's like everyone was wearing a bridesmaid's dress back in that time. But these people are grieving and horrible things happen.
It's so bad.
I have a lot of, yeah.
The reason we see Jane Pauley is because apparently she had, like, a network news show back in the day.
And here is a close-up of a 14-year-old boy in terrible trouble. John David Gosch was kidnapped on a Sunday morning as he delivered newspapers in suburban Des Moines.
The first people we see are Noreen and John Gosch Sr.
Right.
Now, I had seen this documentary before, and I forgot how completely uninvolved the police were, to the point of, like, hindering the finding of the child.
I was going to say, there's uninvolved, there's doing nothing, and then there's actually being a detriment.
Yeah, because Jane Pauley says to the Goshes, like, if anybody has any information on your child, who should they call? And John Gosch Sr. is like,
not the cops.
Here's our home phone number.
Right, yeah.
If someone sees him, what should they do? Who should they call?
They should call our home telephone number, which is area code 515-225-7456.
Well, if anyone sees a little boy that looks anything like Johnny Gosch, call that number.
Thank you very much.
I was like, wait, why are you giving out your home phone number?
I know, because that's how bad it was. And then Noreen says this thing, you know, we're leaving the porch light on every night. That's what moms do.
Johnny, we love you. We're waiting for you to come home. We're doing everything in our power to get you back. And we're leaving the porch light on every night. Moms are like that.
Oh,
and immediately
my God.
You're like, okay, well, this is going to ruin me.
I know.
The rest of my, like, great.
After we cut away from Jane Pauley, they start, I just have to mention this because I wouldn't be me if I didn't.
Sure.
They are interviewing, like, the random people in the town about, like, what they think happened. And you're just, like, watching it. And all of a sudden, this, like, Freddie Mercury, K-U-E-E-N.
Noreen's mom is kind of looked on as kind of a nut anymore, which is too bad, but it certainly affected her drastically.
She's kind of a nut. See, now I hear him as like this Brooklyn guy, kind of like Arnold, like pictures, which is not how he sounds at all.
No, he's got this like sibilant S. He's wearing this like sleeveless t-shirt. I was like, Mary Jane.
Mary Jane. Yeah, he says something. He's like, it's kind of a shame, but she turned out to be kind of a nut, but whatever. And it's like, what? Oh, okay.
I know. I kind of agree with you, Mary Jane.
So now she's become sort of like the go-to person. This is present day Noreen.
Yeah, all of a sudden we see her like in her car.
Which I was shocked to see. I was like, oh, okay. We're following modern day Noreen. Okay,
yeah,
cool.
Yeah.
So she goes to meet Drew and Heather Collins, who are parents who have, their children are missing. And she goes to just help them.
We begin this half hour with a desperate search for two young cousins.
The search continues for 8-year-old Elizabeth Collins and 10-year-old Lyra Cook. The cousins' bikes were found by the lake last Friday.
You are looking at these people and they are just at an absolute loss for how to proceed from one second to the next.
Right. For your child to go missing with no evidence whatsoever to actually like poof and vanish mm-hmm. is something that I can't
yeah.
and probably will never be able to wrap my yeah. mind around. It's insane. And they say these heartbreaking things, you know, like just weird how quiet it is.
What's the biggest thing that concerns you other than getting your daughter back and her safety?
I don't know what's harder, not knowing or knowing. I mean, it's, if there's something bad that's happened,
I know, it's hard. Because when you don't know, your mind kind of imagines what might be
happening.
That's
all we do all day.
Oh my God, I know.
And you're just like, oh my God, who are these monsters that are doing this to these people?
But you're right. Noreen was like, well, the police were awful to me. And I wonder if you're having the same experience.
And they were like, no, they've been great, actually. Yeah. And Noreen's like, that's because I raised hell.
It's true.
And got shit changed.
Yeah, it's true.
And we'll get to that.
We'll get to it. Noreen really has been, again, she ends up kind of crazy in the end, but like the work that she did in the 80s that really changed the way that the police and the nation react to missing children is like a debt that we will never be able to repay this woman.
Yeah, I mean, she took her outrage and just like, I'm sorry, whatness, and turned it into, she used that power for good, really, where she's mm-hmm. like, no, I don't think you understand this.
Yeah. The one other thing we learn about Noreen right quick, and this actually becomes important later, but it made me chuckle in the moment, was that she teaches yoga for stress management.
For 40 years. 40 years she's been teaching yoga. That's crazy.
I know.
And I've been teaching yoga for 40 years. It's a long time. It's a long time to stick with one thing. And people often ask me, well, how can you do the same thing? Doesn't it get boring? No, it works.
Okay, we have to flashback. We have to talk about Noreen's life before she meets John Gosch Sr., Johnny's dad.
Right, so her first husband died of cancer.
Oh my God, but like, so he's a fox, of course. He's right. And she's a fox. Oh my God, they show a picture of her in her wedding dress. I'm like, you guys are the most gorgeous.
Yeah.
But they find out that he gets diagnosed with terminal cancer. Mm-hmm. 2 months before he dies, what happens?
A tornado rips their home apart. That is not hyperbole. Rips their home apart.
Everything was destroyed.
And they have two children.
Oh my
God.
She
can't find the kids.
Nope.
When I started looking for my children, I couldn't find them. I was pulling apart rafters of the house, walls.
And then when she does find them, where are they?
They're like under the rubble.
Face down in a pile of gravel and glass.
And it starts pouring.
And then the rain came, torrents of rain. When the rain hit them, they started screaming. And that was like music to my ears. It meant they weren't dead.
Yeah. She talks about her two previous kids, her two first children, who we do not see in this movie.
No.
Raises some red flags.
I thought that too.
Red flags.
It's weird that she doesn't even say these kids' names. Is that weird?
It's very weird.
Okay.
It's very weird that these kids are not involved in any way, in any way in this documentary. Because Johnny's their half-brother.
Right.
And we never see them. We never hear from them. Like, that definitely raises some questions for me.
Okay, I thought so too.
Yeah. All right, so Noreen is set up with John Gosch Sr. Mm-hmm. They fall in love, get married.
Right.
Have a kid.
Right.
Johnny.
And now this is, of course, the part of the documentary where we hear all the lovely, adorable things about this missing child.
Yeah.
Loved his dog, Gretchen. Gretchen, you're adorable. I hope you're doing well with all the other pups up there.
I was going to say, Gretchen is not still with us.
No.
Yeah.
But We'll get back to Gretchen.
Yeah.
Not just because I love talking about dogs, but we'll get back to her because she's sort of a clue here. But he started doing this paper route to raise money for a bike, and he ends up earning it.
He wanted the paper route because he wanted to get himself a dirt bike.
He became quite the little businessman. He saved his money, and he bought it. And then he and his brother would go riding out in the fields.
Even his dad is just like, he would really go out of his way to find the perfect present for someone's birthday.
Yeah.
I mean, this kid, for a 12-year-old boy, 12 or 13?
13.
13-year-old boy. Most 13-year-old boys are like, meh. But you know, when I think of a 13-year-old boy, I don't think of someone who like takes the time to make sure the person's really going to love this gift that he gets them. You know what I mean?
Yeah, 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 totally.
And it's always like, of course, in these documentaries, this is the part of, I mean, this happens. This is following the formula.
Yeah.
The lovely things come out.
Yeah, of course. Okay, let's talk about the morning Johnny disappears. What happens? What's the timeline?
September 5th, 1982. Super early in the morning, 5:30, getting ready to do the papers, as they say. And John, Big John, John Sr., I'll say, usually helps Johnny with the papers. And parents did this.
Yeah, of course.
You know, like that, you know, it's
I had a paper out for literally one day. My mom got up to help me.
How did that go?
My mom got up to help me, and I was like, this is, Mom, I'm not doing this ever again.
It's still dark out. What is going on? So, of course, every morning, except for that morning, the dad doesn't help him.
On weekends, his dad would help Johnny on the paper route. And that's not what happened.
And I noticed the way the dad said it in the documentary. He said it matter-of-factly. Like, he definitely said, like, I didn't help him that morning. And he was like, I have worked through my guilt on this. It's not my fault.
Right.
People shouldn't steal children.
Right, yeah,
you know,
one is zillion percent.
Totally.
Like, you can wear the short skirt and you can not help your kid on Sunday. Like, whatever. It's fine.
Yeah.
So then, of course, people are like, where's the paper?
That particular Sunday, we got a phone call from one of the neighbors wondering where the paper was.
Of course, Johnny was, like, also really good at his job.
Uh-huh.
That's how he could, you know, earn the money to buy the bike that he wanted. He just, like, he got it done. So the neighbors call because they're like, where are the papers? Johnny's usually all over this. And then the dad just goes out looking.
In the car, yeah.
And finds, this is like so heartbreaking,
I know.
Finds the little wagon, the like Red Ryder wagon, filled with the papers, and Gretchen the dog.
But no Johnny, no sign of Johnny.
Right. It's important that Gretchen is there, and again, we'll get back to it,
yeah.
Not just for dogs.
Yeah.
But that's a big piece of this puzzle in a way, that she is still there.
Yep.
Didn't see him anywhere around, and told Noreen, I said, something's wrong. She called the police right away.
Noreen calls the cops. How do the cops respond?
They're like, is this like the third or fourth time your kids run away? And she's like, he doesn't run away.
It took about 45 minutes before the police arrived.
The police department was only 10 blocks away.
The cop looked at me and he said, well, has your son ever run away before?
A kid never ran away. That really upset us.
Now we meet John Rossi, the witness.
Yeah.
John Rossi is an adult. There's also a witness, Mike, who's a paperboy. There are paperboy witnesses, which makes this a little difficult.
Literally, this is like Newsies. There's like 400 paperboys.
I know.
Don't get me started on Newsies. I'll talk about it for 4 hours.
Okay. Let's.
Okay, so just to dive a little bit deeper into the like actual timeline, right? So 5:45 a.m., Johnny leaves the house. Mm-hmm. And we know this because the neighbor heard the wagon. So Mike, another paperboy, was picking up his papers because there's a gazillion paperboys on the job, noticed that a car stopped and then backed up to like meet Johnny, to like stop and talk to Johnny. So this is when the witness John Rossi is outside, right? And what happens?
So John Rossi, the adult witness, sees this man in the car talking to Johnny Gosch. And Johnny Gosch is a little freaked out, obviously, and calls John Rossi over and is like, hey, can you help this guy? He's asking me for directions and it's creeping me out. Which is also like, great job, Johnny Gosch. Like,
right.
That's what you do.
Totally.
You tell the adult, thank God that guy was out at 5:45 in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
But John Rossi, the way he describes the guy in the car, it's like, yes. Can you just say he was coked up? Because he's like, no, he wasn't drunk. He was alert, and he says like he was raring to go.
He wasn't drunk, but he looked like he's been drinking a lot of caffeine, you know, that kind of thing. Not sleepy. Well, he wasn't sleepy. He was, looked like he was on, you know, ready to go. That's kind of odd at 6 o'clock in the morning.
And I was was like, okay. He goes, he looked like he had a lot of caffeine and he was all hyped up and not really the way you look at 5:45 in the morning. I was like, so he was on coke, John Rossi? You can say that. The guy's probably a monster. To say that he also did coke is like the least of his offenses.
Right, exactly.
He looked angry and ready to go. I was like, that's anyone I've ever seen on cocaine ever.
And so then another witness named Mike sees a tall, slender man come out of the woods between two houses and follow Johnny.
Right.
And then two other newsboys pass Johnny. Again, 800 newsboys right. out, like, in the, delivering papers.
Carrying the banner. My
That's a new. That's a Newsies joke, guys.
Sorry.
And this is when PJ Smith, the homeowner or whatever, like, wakes up and hears, like, the car door close.
At about this time, PJ Smith reported hearing a car door, and upon sitting up in bed, he observed a silver and black Ford Fairmont start up from the area where John Gosch was last seen and made a left turn after rolling through the stop sign without stopping.
I mean, think about this. There's some commotion. It's 5:45 in the morning.
600 news kids out on the sidewalk.
Right. Some coked up maniac asking for directions. And PJ, his eyewitness testimony is that the car ran the stoplight.
Rolled through the stop sign.
So clearly this guy is like, he's a slippery character, as they said in the Amanda Knox documentary about. But the thing that's crazy is that none of this amounts to anything because technically there's not a crime scene.
Nobody saw anything that to us was an explanation for the boy's disappearance. He just vanished. This is just that unsolved, unexplained missing person case.
So there's no crime scene, but there's literally like 9 witnesses.
Right.
I mean, my God, there's so many witnesses.
Right.
They were able to reconstruct what happened like second by second.
I loved how they did that in the documentary.
Yeah.
Give me a good map with moving things.
Oh, yeah.
Things that I'm
Keepers
such a,
nailed it on yeah, that front.
Yeah, totally. I'm such a visual person. I'm just like, I need to follow the little moving dot.
Totally. So then it cuts to like 4 days after the disappearance. Mm-hmm. Parents are a wreck. Mom's in full makeup.
The cops are doing what?
Literally nothing.
They are trying to catch people in speed traps, you guys.
As far as any surprises by the police department, I think every day was a surprise. Most of the time they weren't doing much. One day when we had people searching all over the area, I pulled up and there was a policeman sitting there shooting radar for speeders, like 2 blocks from our house. I told him, I said, put that gun away and go find my son, you know?
Meanwhile, the entire town is like, hi, excuse me.
Right.
A child up and vanished.
Yeah.
Let's focus.
The other thing that happens in this part is that one of the journalists talked to a bunch of journalists in this episode, in this movie. And the journalist is like, you guys don't understand how bad it was in 1982. So just for the record, in 1982, police had to wait 72 hours before they could file a missing persons report for a child. Mm-hmm. The FBI would track your stolen car across state lines, but not your missing kid. And there was absolutely no infrastructure in place to support the hunt for missing children.
Right. You were really...
Like, no national database.
Yeah.
And I want to say, too, that it's never really fleshed out in the movie, but the idea that the police are covering something up is definitely floated.
Oh, yeah.
At this point. What is the police chief's name?
Chief Orville Cooney.
You guys are making this too easy for us.
It's like, who was that guy? Yosemite Sam? with the big mustache? And it's like, yes. The pew, pew, pew. He's like an evil little idiot. And the reporter that you're talking about, Frank Santiago.
Yeah. Wow. You just have all the names.
All in caps. All in caps. I do my research. Chief Orville Cooney. I have to say it with that tone because it's like, you're kidding, right? It's like his parents named him, and it's like, he's going to grow up to be garbage, you guys. Let's do it. He is quoted as saying, I don't give a damn about what Noreen Gosch says. Girl, you should.
I interviewed Orville Cooney, and believe me, I remember this. Says, I don't give a damn about what Noreen Gosch has to say. And that set off the fireworks.
Mr. Orville Cooney, please take several seats.
Several seats and give a shit about what the parent of a missing child has to say. Would it kill you?
I know. I will
say... Like, I stay on brand. I get it. Stay on your brand as, like, the cartoon villain. But enough is enough. And then it turns out, guess what? 17 out of the 32 cops in the department come out and they're like, oh, dude, he's a nightmare. He's totally a nightmare.
The Des Moines Tribune reports 18 officers making allegations against Chief Cooney.
Right.
He does police work drunk.
Wait, this is my favorite. This is my favorite charge that's ever been levied against anybody in the world. One of the charges against him was doing police work after drinking.
Yeah. And it's like, I get it.
I mean, have a cocktail at 7 o'clock.
I know. I edit podcasts with a cocktail every once in a while. And he's a racist.
Yep.
He jukes the stats.
What?
Jukes the stats. Didn't you watch The Wire? When they mess with the numbers to make it look good for them.
No, that's called what?
Juking the stats. It's like cooking the books. Anyway.
Sorry.
But what he would also do is like change tickets, like get his friends and family out of trouble. Like he totally lived up to Orville Redenbacher or whatever his name is, Orville Cooney. God.
Both Cooney and Mayor George Mills say the actions of this many officers in a 37-person department cannot be ignored.
He's the worst, and he's forced to resign, so he's out of the way. Thank God that nightmare is over.
The man was not handling the case correctly. It was later proved that he wasn't. He needed to be removed from office.
So this part of the search is where they bring in Ken Wooden.
Yeah.
He's like this was mind-blowing, but I guess I get it. So the whole idea of bringing this guy in is that he's an expert on pedophilia.
Right.
A word that Noreen had never heard before.
And many of the people.
Yeah.
I had never heard the word pedophile. And most of the people around us in this community had never heard the word either.
They would hold like town meetings where these people would come and present.
You know, we brought in George Gallup, we brought in Ken Wooden, world famous, both of them world famous. And we had seats set up for 500 people. 45 people came. It's unbelievable. The Register didn't cover it. No TV stations covered it.
Parents did not want to think about this sort of thing happening.
Right. But and now we're just like, how do you not know what pedophilia is? Mm-hmm. Like, but back then they didn't. I remember in 82, like no internet, no viral news stories. This was, I'm sure, I hate to say it, happening all over the place. But they didn't know because news didn't travel the way it travels now.
Right.
And because people just didn't want to deal with it.
Right.
It's too scary. It's too horrible.
So this is the part where the dog comes back.
Yeah. So Ken Wooden says,
a newspaper boy serving papers missing, and his dog was still there. And it was obvious. If the dog was still there, he was no runaway.
That the fact that the dog was there and everything else was there is the sign of a pedophile. That he just took the 13-year-old boy. That's disgusting to say.
Right.
But he's like, because there was no crime scene, they just scooped him up. And he's like, that's like pedophilia sex ring that has that written all over it.
Right.
And the cops are like, we got to get our quota for the speed traps, though. Thanks for playing. We're going to go in a different direction.
So almost 2 years to the day after Johnny Gosch is kidnapped, the parents are getting no help from the FBI. They're getting no help from the police. They're being like vilified by the police and the FBI, calling them cranks and crazy and Noreen's.
Yeah, he's a runaway.
Too intense. And, right.
Oh, yeah. Another hysterical woman. Don't even get me started. I will flip this table.
Well, I have to say, we are told time and again by everybody that Noreen was demanding.
Noreen is not, never has been, as far as I know, a shrinking violet. She will not just stay home and cry in her handkerchief. There were stories about cops who wanted off this case so bad because they couldn't handle this woman.
You never see her with a hair out of place or riled up in any way in this. Every time she talks on camera, she is focused. Mm-hmm. She knows exactly what she wants to say.
Yeah. You never see her as hysterical as she has every single right to be.
Absolutely. Exactly.
She could be she could be pulling, remember the woman who wasn't there? She was like screaming and crying on the side of the street.
Yeah.
She could be doing that on the news and that would be totally valid.
Yeah.
But meanwhile, she's like, hey, so if you know what, call me directly. The cops aren't doing anything. If you have anything, that would be great.
Right.
And it's like, this hysterical woman is too much for us to handle. Okay. Well.
So what happens almost 2 years to the day?
August 14th, 1984, Eugene Martin, 13, disappears.
The nightmare for the Martin family began August 12th, 1984. In those first days, FBI agents and volunteers searched the city for clues.
He disappears while delivering papers. Witnesses say they saw him talking to someone in a car. Everything is the same as Johnny. And the cops,
what did the police
once
say?
Again, are like, I don't see a connection here. What are you guys, crazy? It's just a 13-year-old boy delivering papers, talking to a witness in a car and everything. And he just vanished into thin air. It has nothing to do with Johnny Gosch. I don't know what you're talking about.
The police say they cannot connect those two stories, which I find kind of incredible. There's so many similarities, you know, at the same date, time, conditions? How could you not think they were connected?
And the entire town is collectively like pulling their hair out.
Yeah.
Like, oh my God. And then we meet Lieutenant Bob Rushing, which like...
Oh, listen, Rushing. Another one. We need to open some of these folding chairs for us so we can take several seats.
He was like, the only thing similar is their gender.
Right.
We worked in depth trying to find a connection. We did not find a connection. The boys were dissimilar in most aspects other than their gender.
I was like, wait. And their age and their, quote, occupation and the time of day and that they were talking to a man.
Time of year.
Time of year. Do I have to go on?
Right. No.
Can I have your job, you idiot? And then by September of 1984, a local dairy put Johnny and Eugene's faces on the side of their milk cartons. Even the local dairy was like, all right, we got it. If the cops aren't doing anything, we'll do what we can. And they put these, you know, heartbreaking photos on the side of the milk cartons.
So two of the things we find out at this point, two of the things that Noreen has been partially, largely responsible for is the creation for the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. And the Johnny Gosch Bill. What the Johnny Gosch Bill does is it requires law enforcement to act immediately in Iowa when a child is reported missing.
That was somebody's life who was falling apart and their son was lost. And I mean, how do you go on? And she went on and on and on. And for a young reporter, that at times would be frustrating. But now as somebody who has four children, thank you.
But now, did you ever watch America's Most Wanted when you were younger?
Listen, when John Walsh, his voice appeared on the screen before his face, I literally did like the Arsenio Hall fist bump. I was like, John Walsh is here!
John Walsh is going to save the day!
Yeah.
I know what it's like to search for your missing child. I know what it's like to not know what happened. And so I thought, let's go back and look. Maybe somebody will have the guts to finally tell us what happened to Johnny.
So John Walsh is the creator of America's Most Wanted because John Walsh can relate to the Goshes because he has a tragic story about his son, Adam, who went missing and they found his dismembered head.
Really?
120 miles away from their home. So John Walsh immediately is like, well, now I'm an advocate. Now I'm an activist. Now I'm going to do that. And that was the inspiration for America's Most Wanted. So they worked together to get these bills and do all that.
A series of things happen sort of quickly at this point. After we meet John Walsh, we get like a timeline. What happens in 1985?
Okay, I like scream.
I know.
Someone gets changed from a grocery store in Sioux City, and it's a dollar bill with a handwritten note that says, I'm alive, and it's signed by Johnny Gosch.
Right.
You guys!
I know, that's crazy.
The signature is right in this area.
He was somehow able to communicate that he was still alive.
Now, listen, anybody could do that.
Absolutely.
Anybody could write it. Sure. I mean, they didn't get into, like, if the handwriting was similar. We never see that part of it. But it's super creepy.
Yeah. And you just this is a good time to say there is a rabbit hole of information and conspiracy theories in this. There was handwriting done on this.
They just didn't get into it in the movie.
No. So that's the thing. Like, we're just going to focus on what we learn.
Wait, can you tell me real quick? And then we won't focus on anything else outside of the movie.
Yeah, where it's like, there is, but there, you know, handwriting. Handwriting is really tough. Handwriting can't even be introduced in court in criminal cases.
Right.
It's like, and that's like eyewitness testimony is also the least reliable. So yeah, it's like the handwriting. It could be some kid. It could be, I don't know when the dollar was minted, which is important.
Uh-huh.
So I don't know a lot about that. It could be someone playing the cruelest joke ever.
Right.
But of course, Noreen, who wants everything to point to Johnny, is like, aha!
That's him. So then in 1986, what happens?
14-year-old Mark Allen, another Des Moines teen, disappears.
He walked out the door and the kids were getting ready to have pizza. And I'll never forget it as long as I live. The last thing he said to me as he walked out the door was, save me some pizza, Mom. I'll be hungry when I get home. And he waved when he got to the bushes, and I waved at him, and that was that, and I never saw him again.
Okay, so then in 1991, who do we meet?
Paul Benacci, but they call him Benassi, so that's what I'm saying.
Paul Benassi was a victim of a child prostitution network that was centered in Omaha, Nebraska. And 9 years after Johnny Gosch's abduction, Paul Benassi came forward and claimed that he helped abduct Johnny Gosch. That was the big bang in the Johnny Gosch case.
All right, tell me everything.
He's an inmate at the Lincoln Correctional Center in Nebraska, and he comes forward saying that he wants to help this case, and he says that he helped abduct Johnny for this child prostitution ring for this dude named Emilio.
And he did that because he had at some point been abducted or whatever and was a part of this ring.
He was a part of the ring. And we'll get into the details proving why he could be involved in this ring, what he knows, but they don't go into how he got out of the ring.
Right. And was and wound up in jail.
Right. Yeah. So I'm super curious as to how he got out of this awful yeah. situation.
So Noreen finds out about him and says she needs like some time before she can go meet him face to face. But then like the documentary crew follows her as she goes to like have her one-on-one meeting with Paul Bonacci.
Right.
The video can't pick up just how badly Noreen Gosh is shaking as she sees Paul Bonacci in the flesh for the first time. He fills out a consent form, not knowing who this woman is.
This is Johnny's mother. Mrs. Gosh wanted to talk to you.
Just tell me what happened, please.
And we learn awful things. He's 24 at the time. He says he's been sexually abused since he was 6. He is also a sex offender.
Yes.
And he claims to have multiple personality disorder, and he can summon these personalities
at will.
At will.
I can hear what these other personalities are saying and stuff and the things that they've done. I mean, like with Johnny and...
So the meeting between Paul Bonacci and Noreen is real intense. Let's talk about then the story that he tells Noreen. Noreen's like, tell me what happened.
And again, there's chloroform involved, you guys.
Oh my God, chloroform. Chloroform to me, I'm always like, what is chloroform like a real thing?
Yes. Check my Google search history, which is so weird and creepy.
You know, I didn't want to Google it because I didn't want that in my Google search history.
Yeah, but now you have the screenshots from my phone on your phone.
So Paul Bonacci tells Noreen that he was with a man in a car and that his job was to chloroform Johnny.
Right.
And then like throw him in the back of the car.
And then, so in this conversation, Paul draws Noreen a map of where the plan was to abduct Johnny on his paper route, however you say it.
Bonacci drew a map of the clan, a replica of one drawn by the kidnappers. Noreen Gosh says this X marks the exact spot of the abduction.
He drew the map so specifically, and the pickup point was not on the corner as it was
where lots of people think it was.
Often.
She says most people mistakenly believe it happened at the corner.
But it was perfectly off the corner.
Yeah. Paul got that right.
Right. And that's one of the many things he got right that weren't publicized. He mentions the birthmark. The birthmark was all over the news.
He had a birthmark on his chest or something on his chest. It was like looked like South America.
He mentions that he has a scar on his tongue from when he was younger and bit through it when he fell.
Yeah.
That was not publicized. He knew that.
Yeah.
He knew that there was a burn from on his leg from, I think, like his brother's dirt bike or something. That was not publicized. Paul knew that. He also knew that Johnny, this brings tears to my eyes. He stammers when he gets upset and agitated. That was not publicized. Paul knew that. And
the big one was that Noreen does yoga. That right. Noreen had taught him yoga.
He talked about something about meditation, but I don't know what that meant, or yoga, or some kind of... But then he said something about that he'd seen his mom do that or something, or she taught him how to do that.
But the way he says it is something like a meditation. He didn't know exactly what it was, but as he's described, he's like, yoga or meditation or something,
yeah.
And like he knew how to do some of that. And it's sort of like, as you're experiencing this, it's like you're talking to like a medium or a psychic.
Right.
Who's like,
and Noreen is like,
I have never told the press that Johnny went with me to yoga classes. It wasn't relevant to his kidnapping.
The cops from Johnny's town never go to question this guy.
Never, ever. And when they show that on the like on-screen text, I'm like, oh, for fuck's sake. Really?
I know.
Because
they're like, maybe we will. Maybe if the time is right, maybe we'll go.
We're waiting.
And it's like, just go hear the guy out.
Can you just, he's singing like a canary. Just talk to him. He's telling everybody who'll listen.
Yeah. So then America's Most Wanted gets involved.
So John Walsh is like, guess what?
Yeah.
I'm using my America's Most Wanted power.
Nobody had found Johnny, so any excuse is a good excuse to keep it in the light.
And now it's 1992. It's the 10th anniversary of Johnny Gosh being abducted. So what they do is they take, Paul is giving them more information. There's this house in Colorado.
We went to Colorado with Bonacci. You know, he said, I'll show you the house where they used to keep us. And he described this house with this secret underground chamber where they would hide the kids when the police would come.
Well, he also mentions that Johnny had tried to run away once, so he's been branded with like an actual brand. So America's Most Wanted goes to the house. They go to Colorado. They take Paul. And they're like, we didn't think the house was really going to be there.
And there it was. It's abandoned. We go underneath it, and sure enough, there's this chamber dug out under the house with kids' initials carved in the wood.
Paul, like, can't be there,
yeah,
obviously.
He's freaking out.
A lot of trouble with it. And then there's, like, the guy from America's Most Wanted, not John Walsh, like, his producer, and he's like, we were just like, oh, shit. Like,
yeah, this is real.
This is so real.
So then the producer is talking about how, like, they have all this evidence now. Now they believe Paul, but they keep hitting these dead ends.
So that there was this sense that we're really close, you know, something is going on here. But every time we found a clue, we ran into a brick wall. The owner of the house, which had been abandoned, was a former prison guard who disappeared. You know, the people who had composite drawings never became real people. We never had names. We never could go after them as individuals. We couldn't expose them and get them brought in for questioning.
So then the episode airs, and people kind of just don't believe it. But then these kids who say they were part of the string start coming forward, and one of them has the exact brand that Paul said Johnny had.
And then these kids started calling us. This one kid came forward named Jimmy, who had the brand and was telling these stories and confirming what Bellacci was talking about.
And it's more than one kid.
Yeah.
And now it's like, okay, this is now a ring. This is now some sort of crazy, scary, horrible prostitution child
sex ring.
So
it's like Johnny was either a part of this or not, but this actual like sex ring really did exist.
Right.
The next thing that happens is kind of a non sequitur. There's this whole thing about the Franklin Credit Union scandal. Can we just go through this quickly? Because it comes kind of to nothing.
Yeah, it's Larry King, not CNN Larry King. Right. Lawrence E. King, Larry E. King. He embezzled $40 million with this credit union. And it also turned out that he was using that money to like buy and sell young boys for these very prominent politicians.
Paul Bonacci being one of them.
Right. And he also says that he was like damaged goods and they wanted like kids who had never been abused before. It's horrifying. Flipping a table. These people are garbage. It's the closest thing to like an actual like evil thing in this world.
But they never get him on it. He like only goes to jail on the money embezzling.
Yeah. And then Paul Bonacci tries to sue. He sues him in civil suit for $1 million, wins. Does he
and
ever get that money?
Never gets the money.
Nope.
Fine. Moving on. It's the weirdest part of the documentary that I'm like, what is happening here?
Yeah.
So the major new thing, the major thing that we find out towards the end is that Noreen had to testify in that trial. And when she was on the stand, one of the prosecutors, whatever, somebody asked her, have you ever had any contact with your son since he disappeared? And she doesn't answer. And the judge says to her, if you don't answer, you'll be in contempt of court. So she had to answer. And what does she say?
Yeah. Yep.
So I said once, I saw my son once.
2 whole years ago.
What happened?
Johnny came to the door with some other guy.
There was a knock on my door, a persistent knocking. And I went to the door and I could see a young man standing out there. And I kept looking at his eyes. And the eyes don't change. And so I said, who is it? And he said, it's me, Mom. Johnny.
So he comes in for like 2 hours with his friend. And he's like, basically, she says, he tells the story about escaping from this sex ring, and if he's committed all these crimes as a part of this sex ring, and if he were to come out, then he'd go to jail or they'd kill him.
Right. Like that's what they do. They make the kids do all this illegal stuff too, so that even if they, and this is totally bullshit.
This whole story is bullshit. I don't know why she's making, are we on the same page with this?
Yeah.
It's all made
but
up.
But I also think what's bullshit, if it's true, let's just say, or these sex rings do this thing where it's like, you can't go because I made you steal this, whatever. Like, that's not how it works.
Right.
And then in a very short time, it was over, and he said, I have to go.
Do you believe that this encounter happened?
No.
Why do you think she would make it up?
I mean, I don't know. I really can't speak to why she would make it up.
There's part of me that thinks some kid did come to her door,
right,
and she let herself believe that it was Johnny, and he said he was Johnny. But like you and I were furiously texting this morning, in no world is there a situation in which he would come to the house and she would ever let him leave.
No, you re-kidnap him again for his own good.
You tie him up.
You
tie him the hell up. The hell up.
For his own safety.
Yeah, exactly.
For his own goddamn safety.
Yeah.
And you run and scream like a banshee to anyone who'll listen to you. Holy shit, I have my kid.
Yeah.
Or I have someone who's telling me this thing.
Yeah. It's all crazy and it's not real. But
and she was like, I kept my mouth shut for 2 years. I was like, why?
I know.
Because, and then she goes, why? Because he asked me to.
Right.
Okay, well.
It was very simple. My son asked me not to say anything.
It just, it, that's the point in the movie where I was like, oh, she's gone crazy. Like, she's actually gone crazy.
And I hate to say that.
Yeah.
Because it's
she
like,
did so much important work. And
I am fortunate enough to not have any experience with this. I don't know what yeah. goes on and what kind of person you become when this happens.
There's one other thing that happens where, like, in 2006, people start emailing her photos of boys, like, hogtie. I mean, it's so horrifying, guys.
I cannot get these images out of my head. I don't think I ever will.
Yeah.
I could not get my breath. And I thought I was going to pass out at seeing my son like that.
But again, they're clearly not him. And she's like, it's clearly my son. That's my son. You don't have to believe me. If you, her ex-husband, Johnny's dad, is like, that's not him.
It's not him.
First of all, there's no birthmark on his chest. And the picture does not even look like him. His feet were much larger than that even when he was kidnapped. So your feet, even if you've lost a lot of weight, still stays the same length. So.
Right. And then the police say, well, that's from the 70s. And then there's another story where it's like they were hogtying themselves and it was a game and they tried to get themselves out of it. And I'm like, no, that's not a fucking game.
Right.
Like the look in these kids, like it's not a game.
Yeah.
But it's proven that it was, you know, three of the kids were identified. There's a picture of one boy and then a picture of three. And three of them were identified from the 70s. And the one wasn't. And the one that wasn't,
she's like, clinging to, like, that's him, that's him, that's him.
And it's just not.
No. Based on the number of true crime documentaries, podcasts, articles I've read, if I had to put money on what I think happened to Johnny Gosch, I would say he was dead within 24 hours after he was kidnapped. Hmm. What do you think?
I think that there are psychotic, sickening rings like this in existence. I think they're real. I think a lot of things that Paul said prove that.
Yeah.
That house was real. I mean, we saw the footage. The branding is real. The kids' names, like, that's all real. This shit happens. It's disgusting. I'm going to have nightmares about it, but it happens. It's evil and horrible. Did it happen to Johnny Gosch? I hope it didn't happen to anybody, but I keep going back to the fact that other paper boys were taken, but I don't know what that means. I don't know. I hope I'm wrong.
Me too. You guys, thank you so much for your iTunes reviews. Keep them coming. We're up to like 107. I know. I'm obsessed, or maybe more than that now.
Oh my God.
Jillian, news items.
Okay, so this is a little, everyone's going to be like, wait, what? Like the record scratch is going to happen. But I host a podcast called The Hamilcast. It's about Hamilton, an American musical. I am hosting a Hamilton happy hour, and Patrick will be bartending with me.
Oh, hey.
We're going to be behind the bar. We're playing the entire Hamilton cast recording from beginning to end. And it's at Offside Tavern in New York City, 137 West 14th Street, August 12th. Hamilton starts at 8 on the dot. It's free. You have to like pay for your drinks, obviously.
Yeah.
But it's for 21 and over. I'm sorry, but it's a bar. We're going to be dancing and singing and like screaming at each other.
Yeah.
There are going to be raffles if you want to get tickets to Hamilton. Raffling off tickets to Hamilton from Graham Wyndham, Eliza's Orphanage. And we're going to raffle off some props that were used on Broadway. And I just got email confirmation today raffling off Broadway con tickets.
Oh my God, I'm obsessed with you guys. You poor true crime people who are like, what are you guys talking about?
It's just gibberish right now. They have no.
So come and see us. Follow us on Twitter. We're obsessed. We're at True Crime Obsessed, no ED. Instagram, Facebook. You can find everything at truecrimeobsessed.com.
Yep.
Okay, and what are we going to do next week?
The Witness.
Oh my goodness. I think you can stream it on Amazon, and if we can find a link where you can watch it for free, like, we'll put it up on our Twitter. But here's the trailer, and stay tuned afterwards for outtakes from today's show.
Exactly what was it you heard?
Save me, save me.
Didn't this frighten you or shock you?
No.
I was 16 when my sister Kitty was murdered in New York City. For years, I avoided the details of that night, but it's worse not knowing the truth. The Times story was seen as proof that New York City was uncaring, and my sister's been the symbol of bystander apathy for decades.
No one investigated the 38, no one followed up on it or anything of that nature.
Was it worth all the attention it got, or was it a media creation?
It's a fascinating story.
and undoubtedly sold newspapers.
I heard somebody saying, help, help. I called the police.
You called the police?
Always.
The story doesn't make any sense to me.
I'm sick of listening to people tell you 38 people stood by and watched. That's not so.
It really doesn't take a lot to kill a person, I guess.
Maybe we could start it off by talking about what it is you're trying to accomplish by having a meeting with Winston Mosley.
The choices that he made in his life were all related to the fact that no one helped his sister. And if he knows the truth, that's a peacefulness.
At what point are you going to be satisfied?
50 years later, we're still talking about Kitty.
I can't stop until I feel like it's over.
Yeah,
like,
when is it over?
I'll know when it's over.
Can I ask you something? Because you texted me about it and we haven't addressed it yet.
What?
I don't know if this is just like a level of assholery that we shouldn't go to, but like her modern day hair.
She's wearing a wig.
Do you know that I've seen this documentary? This is the third time. And it wasn't until right before I got the text from you that I was like, is that a wig?
Yeah. And okay, like, my hair would be thinning, too, if I was going through absolute hell. Whatever you gotta do, Noreen. Do you?
Yeah.
Whatever, man. You changed the way, hopefully, law enforcement deals with missing and exploited children. There is a missing and exploited children's unit because of you.
Because of you. Yeah.
You wear those shoulder pads. You wear that hair. You do you. You got this. You have a free pass. August 14th, 1984, Eugene Martin, 13, disappears.
Handsome devil.
Yes.
And I'll probably take that out because that is so creepy to say.
Super creepy. That's why I was like, yep, yeah, moving on.
And then two other newsboys pass Johnny. Again, 800 newsboys out, like, in the delivering papers.
Carrying the banner.
That's a newsies joke, guys.
Sorry. If I had, I'm like, do I have it on my phone? Can I listen to it on the way home? Every morning.
Weez go where Weez wishes. Weez as free as fishes.
Sure beats washing dishes. What a fine life. Carrying the banner home.
Okay, you're doing the movie version.
Yes.
That's the movie version. They took it out for the Broadway version.
I know.
That's my favorite part of the whole movie.
No.
That's my favorite part.
I'm such a Newsies purist. I'm sorry, Newsies on Broadway.
Me too.
I was like, first what's you don't spot have Bell.
What's Bob Conlin's line?
Never fear, Brooklyn's here. What are you kidding me? Scott Conlin and his green eyes? Come
Wait,
on.
Wait, what did you call him?
Spot Conlin.
Did you call him Scott?
Did I by mistake?
Mm-hmm.
I get riled. It's the green eyes. I can't help it.